Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. When we talk about healthcare, remember that medical care itself is only purported to impact about 20% of our overall health. It's other factors like education, employment, water, and critically, nutrition that constitute the remainder of our overall health. Nutrition means food. And where does our food come from? Modern convenience allows us to go to the grocery store and buy things we need and want, time and time again at consistent prices. But what goes into making that experience so commoditized? My guest today has spent more than 5 years embedded in different aspects of the grocery industry, from factory farms to USDA training, long-haul trucking, working with store buyers, at trade shows with entrepreneurs, and working as a fishmonger at a Whole Foods grocery store in the Bowery in New York City. Moreover, his reportage teaches us that the race to commoditize food, its processing and transport, puts heavy downward pressure on those at the lowest rungs of the food chain, up to and including slavery-like conditions of Burmese fishermen in Thailand, for example. Benjamin Lohr is a writer. His previous book, an expose on Bikram or hot yoga, is called Hellbent. His new book is called The Secret Life of Groceries, The Dark Miracle of the American Supermarket, and it's just out from Avery. Benjamin Lohr, welcome to Medical Monday. I was really interested in sort of your part two of the book, which was about how food gets to market. And it's really how, not just in grocery world, but how all goods get to pretty much all retail establishments, which is trucking. And you embedded with a trucker by the name of Lynn Riles. How did you meet Lynn, and why did she agree to let you drive with her for so long?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I can't speak to why she let me drive to her, other than I think she wanted her story told, because so much of the trucking world is obfuscated. And I think people walk around with ideas of what the trucking world is like because we see them on the road, we pass them on the highway, but they really have no clue what's going on. So I met Lynn through kind of the reportorial chain of just asking people to put me in touch with people who put me in touch with other people. I started digging into trucking, and I realized quickly that it was a fascinating story of an industry that went from kind of blue collar, middle class profession to something that was defined by kind of a commodification of the human driver and a race to the bottom economics. And that had kind of overlapped with a lot of the other themes in the book. And I wanted to focus within that world on a female trucker, because I think all of the vulnerabilities that our male truckers face, the female trucker faces them to an even more extreme degree. So I thought using a female trucker character would help tell that story its most clear fashion.
Yeah, so for one thing, there really aren't that many female truckers, right? It's a pretty big minority in the trucking world.
Yeah. I think it's about 5% of drivers are women. It's definitely a minority within the profession, which on one hand doesn't make any sense, because trucking is definitely a gender-neutral profession, right? It's not like some athletic contest where there's some reason why there should be, you know, a male-dominated. It's not like timber cutters or something. Not that there can't be female timber cutters, but it's very sociological, right? It has to do with this kind of macho ethos in the profession. And it turns out some of the structural ways that truckers are trained, which, you know, I get into in the book, where you obviously don't leave CDL, which is commercial truck driving license school, knowing how to drive a truck flawlessly. You have to train with someone. And when you're training with someone, you're living with them essentially in a truck driving team. So you're sharing this kind of small 11 by 11 space. And of course, if you have a male trainer and a female trainee, there's a lot of room for abuse. And that is one of the big stories in trucking.
Yeah, and she experienced that quite a bit. And moreover, when you stopped at truck stops, I mean, she never, it sounds like, walks between two trucks. She's very loath to spend any time kind of hanging out at the truck stop. She doesn't like to use the bathroom. She'll urinate in a plastic bag in her cab or in the back there.
Lynn is, the woman I call Lynn, if you met her, she is a big, strong, macho, no-nonsense, gruff kind of person, and you would never imagine her being intimidated by anything or anyone. And yet the fact is that she felt truck yards as a woman were extremely dangerous. She knew multiple people who had been assaulted. One very close friend who, an associate who was raped. And the fact that she, of all people, would speak to that and acknowledge even that vulnerability for someone who really didn't acknowledge much of vulnerability, it exemplified just how bad things were.
Well, I got to ask you one more thing about trucking, and then we can kind of leave that. But it's just the idea that truckers, you know, in theory, I guess we'd like to think they have their own autonomy. I mean, that is, as it's become less unionized, we'd like to think truckers can, you know, sort of choose to drive as much or as little as they want, but that's not at all how it is. And you describe that CDL, you know, training where, for example, the character you call Lynn, I mean, she's heavily in debt. I mean, and she had to go, I mean, it's almost like indentured servitude, for lack of a better. I mean, so she is behind the eight ball, and it seems like really not making enough to make ends meet. I mean, it is a race to the bottom, and it was very sobering to read that.
Yeah, I think the big story in OTR trucking, over-the-road trucking, is this race to the bottom, and is the fact that deregulation was an amazing thing for the consumer. It resulted in much cheaper freight. It resulted in cheaper prices at the checkout for that reason. It resulted in truck drivers, however, being turned into essentially commodity workers who were replaceable. And the long-term effects of that is that the industry has figured out ways of exploiting driver turnover. Right now in the trucking industry, driver turnover hovers between something like 97 to 110%, which are, again, percentages of turnovers that almost don't make any sense. Like 100% turnover means everyone in the fleet is being let go and then rehired in that year. And the way they have made sense of this as an industry is to actually make big profits off of new trainees by engaging them on what the training rates. And
they pay for their own training, these trainees.
They pay for their own training. They take out debt for their own training, and then they take out debt again to become owner operators of their own truck. And that debt gets kind of wielded like a threat in their life. And it acts, they get kind of beholden to only one trucking company, the one who holds their debt. They can't really go out on the free market and take whatever jobs come to them. And then because they're trainees, they get offered training rate prices, and they can get stuck in that situation for quite a while, and the job becomes really grueling. And what's fantastic, and I think what I also didn't realize about trucking, is just what a difficult mental challenge it is to be a trucker. Trucking is one of the most dangerous professions out there. More people are killed trucking than just about any other industry. At least when I was writing the book, that was true. You know, it's right up there with deep sea fishing in terms of most dangerous jobs. And it takes a lot of vigilance to drive that truck for the 70 hours a week you're out on the road. And so you combine that kind of vigilance and threat with these deregulated wages, and you get a really difficult profession and the people who are going through really difficult times. And that was something I wanted to call attention to in the book, because I think truckers are people we rely on as a country, and we don't give them near enough credit.
Well, you spent about 5 years reporting and then, you know, time writing the book. I guess one thing I'm wondering is, have you kept in touch? Do you know how Lynn is doing now, or if she's still at it?
I talked to Lynn. I called her up to go over quotes and kind of details with her. And then I got an email from her kind of out of the blue, maybe a month before the book was going on. I would say that the update was not so great. So in the book, she's an owner operator. And as I discuss, almost all owner operators eventually lose their truck because they can't make payments on it. Or if they decide that they want to leave that particular trucking company, they also lose their truck because they have to stick with that company to keep the truck in their contract, despite the fact that they're making regular payments on it. And she had just lost her truck. and she was with a new trucking company, kind of starting all over again. One thing to note about truckers, and I don't want to make too many broad generalizations, but there is a culture of autonomy and a culture of like responsibility where, despite what I as an outsider would see as like structural reasons for failure, a lot of them take it very personally and see it as a matter of duty and don't like to ascribe blame anywhere else. So Lynn was not in a place where she was blaming anyone for this. She just thought it was a consequence of her not, you know, a combination of bad luck and not working quite hard enough, which was, of course, also heartbreaking to hear because I think she was an extremely hard worker.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is writer Benjamin Lohr, whose brand new book is called The Secret Life of Groceries, The Dark Miracle of the American Supermarket. And we were just talking about one of those dark aspects, which is trucking, which has certainly benefited us as consumers. But this book really makes you think about where your food comes from. And one of the really engaging parts was someone else you write about who is a great example of the sort of entrepreneurial aspect. And her name is Julie Boucher. She has a product, which I admit I did not look up, but it sounds like it was making some progress, called, I guess, Slawsaw, which is a mixture of, if I said it right, coleslaw and salsa, kind of a clever idea. And you met her at, I guess, a food fair. And one of the sobering things is that 89% of the people that try to break into the food industry fail. I was kind of shocked by that. So, you know, hobbyists that make their own condiment or salsa or barbecue sauce or something and think, well, people say, hey, your sauce is good. You ought to bottle it and sell it. You know, that's just not an easy thing to do. Why is it so hard to break in if you have something that seems novel or good?
It's a good question. I think a lot of us walk around with this notion, like, I make a good guacamole. If I took the time and put it in a bottle, I could probably do this. And my experience with Julie and Slawsaw was exactly the opposite. I mean, Julie was a fantastically smart, hardworking person who was investing her whole life into this product. And watching her slog was amazing. Why is it so hard? It's hard because, one, I think most people don't understand the grocery game. You think that you're competing against your competitors. And so if you're a slaw, so you're only competing against other slaws, condiments, pickles and relishes and coleslaw. And that's partly true, but you're also competing against the store itself, which is operating a lot more like a landlord than an open platform for selling. Stores sell shelf space frequently. This is an industry-wide practice, and that goes down to inches anywhere in the store, not like some fancy end cap, which you assume would be sold for product placement purposes. But we're talking space on the shelf anywhere in some chains. Other chains will come in different forms, whether it's asking for free product, so like a case of Slawsaw that they might then sell at 100% a markup, or a buy one, get one free, where you're subsidizing deals, or promotional fees where they advertise you in some phony baloney internal magazine and you pay for that privilege. But they come at you with all sorts of different fees that act as rocket fuel to their bottom line, adds to their margin, but is essentially extractive for you if you're a young entrepreneur trying to get your foot in the door. So that's one of the things that I had no understanding of until I wrote the book. But there are other, you know, I think I and many people browsing the aisles are under the impression that kind of the best food wins. And that's what, if you're a grocery buyer, you're after. And the best food isn't really what the grocery buyer is after. The grocery buyer is after the best margin. And to do that, there are a lot of things beyond food taste variables that go into that, whether it's shelf life, whether it's, you know, cost of goods and stable commodities that are underpinning it. It's just a whole complicated web of factors that the food entrepreneur has to take care of that the person making guacamole at home doesn't have to pay any mind to.
You encapsulated that so well there, but it is extremely complex. And it opened my eyes, your book does, to just how complex that world is. And right, it you don't win on initiative. It takes a whole heap of that and taste and quality, you'd think. But as you point out, the buyers are not necessarily commensurately interested in those things. Well, you embedded yourself. We talked about trucking. You learned a lot about the entrepreneurial side, but you worked at a grocery store. You worked at a Whole Foods in the Bowery in New York City. Yeah. What was that like? It was a real eye-opening experience, too.
Oh, yeah. You know, essentially, my approach to writing, I just want to get as close to the subject as possible. And I didn't think it was possible to understand the grocery store without some in-store experience. I shadowed managers for the book, and I followed around buyers and brokers when they did their job. But I thought that I had to do some time on the retail floor. And so I ended up working as a fishmonger at a Whole Foods. And it was remarkably, I guess I and many of your listeners have probably had minimum wage jobs in the past. I waited tables. I did retail when I was a kid. And like many aspects of our lives, these things have shifted. And there are forces in retail work right now that just weren't at play in terms of scheduling and in terms of shifts in wages. Right now, many retail employees get their schedule on very short notice, and the hours are shifted week to week based on shifts in customer demand, which sounds very sensible if you're a store manager looking to efficiently staff. But if you're an employee looking for regular hours, becomes extremely burdensome. And not only are your hours shifting so you can't get a second part-time job, but your take-home pay is shifting in response. So it's hard to even have fixed costs that you can be certain about. And that was just, again, one of these things where I had memories of these low-paying jobs. And I think it's one thing to have kind of these miserable jobs when you're in high school. It's quite another thing when there are a lot of people who are no longer in high school who are depending on them, and the quality of those jobs is deteriorating because of lack of worker protection.
Yeah, and you gave examples. I mean, you mentioned already that hour shifting, which is, you know, optimization of HR, to, you know, use the corporate phrase, really, and the low pay means that your coworkers or you couldn't get another job if you wanted to. And, you know, it's an unfortunate reality that many people work more than one job. And then, you know, it really wrecks childcare or other types of family issues. So it was just very worker unfriendly.
That's right. And I have to say, what's interesting is how pervasive that can be across the industry. So at the Whole Foods I was working at, for instance, none of those policies were on the books, so to speak. But there was a constant attitude of, oh, you have to be a team player. Like, you're part of the Whole Foods team, and we want you to be part of this team. And there was an unspoken feeling that maybe you could be asked to play for a different team if you didn't kind of accede to the demands of your supervisor in doing something that was maybe not exactly according to official policy, but would help us out in this one pinch. So, you know, it really is one of these situations where the industry as a whole can have really big effects on, like, specific positions.
And Benjamin Lohr, you worked at a Whole Foods. You have a little bit in there because it seems like the deal was struck kind of while you were in the writing process. But, of course, now the behemoth Amazon bought Whole Foods for almost $14 billion. You talk a little bit about that, and you have a commenter, an Earl Schweizer, I think is his name, but it seems like there's been a ton of turnover at Whole Foods, that many people who are on the team aren't on the team anymore. I guess, what can you say that hasn't been said about Amazon's takeover of Whole Foods? Whole Foods is a very popular brand, especially amongst the health conscious, but it is also known as Whole Paycheck because of its prices. Amazon has certainly brought some pricing strategy to Whole Foods to try to lower some of those costs, and it's certainly done more with the online. You know, that may have come about after a lot of your research, but you do have something in there about it. What can you tell us about Amazon's purchase of Whole Foods?
Sure. So Earl was former head of Whole Foods Grocery National. So he had, you know, he had a pretty good eye for what was happening. What was most interesting was a lot of these changes that people are ascribing to the Amazon deal were happening to Whole Foods before. And it kind of a concerted decision by the chain. So for a long time, Whole Foods was the leader in terms of nurturing young entrepreneurs, in terms of actually walking the walk for both sustainability and for labor and forging win-win partnerships. I think there was a lot more to that chain than just slogans. I can't speak to exactly how much that has deteriorated. I can only say that talking to Earl, there was a feeling in the company that they were kind of victims of their own success and that they would nurture young food companies and help organic products get on the shelves. And then they would scale up and jump over to a competitor like Target or Walmart that didn't have the same internal ethos. And that Whole Foods, because it was kind of decentralized and able to nurture these entrepreneurs on the ground, couldn't mimic. They couldn't kind of scale up in the same way. And at the same time, yeah, what you just said about Whole Paycheck was very true. And as a publicly traded company, they were getting beat up on the market for not being able to address that image problem. And so for those kind of confluence of factors, they decided to get big and centralize their buying. And that certainly caused some shifts in terms of, you know, and I think in the book, Earl says they really walked back their win-win partnership strategy in a way where a lot of those prime deals are just coming out of the entrepreneur's pocket in the same way I was talking about slotting fees and free fill on the shelf previously. They were became much more extractive, much less of a nurturing a young entrepreneur and much more of a let's get big and find volume discounts. And now whether they can hold on to that halo of being the one who walks the walk in the marketplace while they're doing that, I don't know. We'll see how that turns out for them.
You have a big first part of the book I have to ask you about on the other quirky, if you will, grocery chain known as Trader Joe's. And we have had a Trader Joe's, our very first one in Tulsa, which I think was the first one in the state of Oklahoma. It's been about 2 years now. And you got to go in depth with the original Joe Coulomb. Is that how you say his name? And
Coulomb.
Yeah. Before he sold. Now, he sold Trader Joe's to the at least one of or both of the brothers who started Aldi's, right? So
yeah. Albert.
Yeah, so the company has changed somewhat, but it seems like the company still has this very high, it's well known in retail circles, I guess, as being legendary because it has the highest revenue per square foot of really any retail establishment, I think. And
not of any retail. I think the Apple Store beats them. I think Tiffany's beats them. But certainly of retail groceries, they dominate sales per square foot.
Tell us about Joe and how he very slowly built up Trader Joe's and kind of, I assume many of our listeners have shopped there, but if you haven't, it's kind of a story worth knowing.
Yeah, and what's fascinating is how much it exists in opposition to a lot of the other trends in the grocery world that I talk about. And it's almost helpful to frame them first. So the grocery industry is based on continuity of goods, this continuity and abundance, right? You go in there and you're going to be able to get the same things and they're going to be there. The grocery manager's phobic of the idea of like a stock out and an empty shelf. And of course, with COVID, you've seen small amounts of that happening, but that's like shattering to the idea of the grocery supply chain. And Joe founded Trader Joe's in a large part because he was running a fleet of convenience stores and big old 7-Eleven entered into his territory. And he realized he just couldn't compete by getting bigger and bigger because he would never get as big as 7-Eleven. This was back in the early 60s. And so he decides to pivot and kind of define a new niche space for himself where he can flourish despite not being the biggest balance sheet in the land. And that's where Trader Joe's comes from. And he does that by being clever, by being creative, by being humanistic, and by investing in his own employees in ways that you just don't see in a lot of the rest of the grocery story that I told it, at the very least. And so it was a real pleasure. I got a chance to interview him for the book. it was a real pleasure to see how his mind works and just get a chance to kind of see the choices that he made that defined his change. And I think in many cases, they were just choices around targeting a specific demographic with items that he thought he could deliver to that demographic better than anyone else could, which, you know, a grocery store trying to get as big as possible and be and serve everyone was kind of serving no one. Similarly, by deciding to pay his employees more than average, he had some of the highest paid buyers in the entire industry. He allowed them to kind of get creative with the supply chain and, if not actually create goods for customers, at least go to existing places and tinker with those products until they would better match what he thought his customers would want. And in many, it's just this idea of kind of bringing back food to the food store, which made him just a total pleasure to get to know.
Well, even though he sold the business and cashed out, as it were, and he pretty much didn't want to work for anybody else, so he got out entirely. But you're pretty even-handed about it. I mean, a lot of people love to celebrate Trader Joe's because it is a bit iconoclastic, but you don't put yourself in that category. I mean, you're critical of it, too, but it does sound like he's an incredible personality. I guess, can we at least feel good about Trader Joe's, or should we feel as skeptical about Trader Joe's as we do about, as I think you make me feel about the rest of the grocery industry?
Yeah, you know, I don't really know. I can say that I think that Trader Joe's still operates on the DNA that Joe built back in the mid-60s and 70s. To what extent it has moved away from his values, I really couldn't tell you, except for that they clearly inform a lot of the choices that the chain is offering. I know that the train operates on essentially the DNA that Joe put out, but it is obviously eroded over time. You know, Joe was a big believer in finding things that existed outside of the continuous homogeny. And over the course of writing the book, I definitely walked into Trader Joe's and saw Trader Joe's brand seltzer, which is about as homogenous as you can get.
Yes.
And right off a conveyor belt. And just to underscore, yeah, I walked into this book a big skeptic about Trader Joe's. In fact, it was one of the reasons I wanted to write the book to begin with. I saw Trader Joe's, and I saw these super happy workers. I saw quirky, interesting products on the shelf that were, you know, often had, like, health signifiers around them, although a lot of them were frozen dinner-y. And I thought, and low prices. And I thought, oh, there's something too good to be true here. This doesn't add up. You know, there's no free lunch in America. Where is this coming from? And so I wanted to scratch that surface. And I can say, at least in terms of Trader Joe, the founder, scratching that surface was a total pleasure. And my cynicism was not rewarded. In fact, I felt kind of renewed that, oh, here's this kind of ingenious entrepreneur out here trying to make our food supply better by being a decent guy.
Benjamin Lohr is an author based in Brooklyn, New York. His new book is The Secret Life of Groceries, The Dark Miracle of the American Supermarket. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening, and please stay safe out there.